Good morning. Welcome to this segment of the Federalist Society's Executive Branch Review Conference with a panel discussion entitled Environmental Justice, Civil Rights, and the Rule of Law. My name is Jeff Wood. I'm a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Baker Botts. I also serve as the chair of the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, and really honored and privileged to be here today with all of you. Our practice group holds events monthly, sometimes several each month, and we aim to produce publications on a wide range of topics at the intersection of constitutional governance, environmental law, and property rights. Our main mission is to host debates between leading scholars and practitioners from diverse viewpoints, and today is certainly no exception. This morning's panel is also co-sponsored by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, led by Ken Marcus, so we greatly appreciate practice group's, and Ken's here as well. Can you say hello? Thank you, Ken. And we appreciate the opportunity to co-sponsor with them. A panel of distinguished attorneys will evaluate efforts in the current administration, building upon executive actions dating back to the Clinton administration, to refocus federal agencies in a whole-of-government manner on environmental justice, or EJ for short. Establishing justice is in the first sentence of our Constitution. Justice, rendering to each what is rightly due, is a cardinal virtue and is deeply rooted in our legal heritage. It's our duty to preserve it, it's our duty to pursue justice, and it's our duty to never take it for granted in any corner of the law. So how should we consider concepts such as environmental justice? How is EJ defined? What are its origins and its ends? What are its statutory and other legal bases? What do longstanding and newly instituted executive orders on EJ, including the order issued just last week by President Biden, what do they require? And how do they affect the daily workings of the federal government? These and other questions are on the minds of our panel and will be the topic of discussion today. Before introducing our moderator, I'd like to take a moment to also recognize those who helped assemble our distinguished panel today and put this program together. Professor Jonathan Adler, Tony Francois, Allison Soman, and Dan Marinoff. So thank you all for your help with this as well. And one quick note on CLE. If you'd like to get CLE credit, there's a QR code that you'll see on your programs as well as on the posters outside. Please sign in and sign out using the QR code. So now it's my privilege to introduce our moderator for today's event. The Honorable Mark Brnovich served as Attorney General of Arizona, the 26th Attorney General of the state, from 2015 to 2023. The son of immigrants who fled communism in Eastern Europe, Attorney General Brnovich has spent most of his professional life serving as a prosecutor at the local, state, and federal levels. In fact, he met his wife, now U.S. District Court Judge Susan Brnovich, while they both worked as prosecutors for the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. He has also served as an Assistant Attorney General with the Arizona Attorney General's Office. From there, he went on to serve as Assistant U.S. Attorney for the District of Arizona. Attorney General Brnovich has also been a judge pro tem of Maricopa County Superior Court, a command staff judge advocate in the U.S. Army National Guard, the director of the Constitutional Governance Center at the Goldwater Institute, and the director of the Arizona Department of Gaming. And he's also served as chairman of the Conference of Western Attorneys General, a nonpartisan organization comprised of AGs from the Western states. General Brnovich, thank you for your service to the state of Arizona. Thank you for agreeing to moderate this important discussion today. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff, and thank you everyone for being here. And I will say I was had the honor of knowing former Justice Scalia, and rest his soul, and I was introducing him at an event one time, and I asked him how he wanted me to introduce him, and he said, the more important your job, the shorter the introduction. So thank you for that lengthy introduction. That was way too long. I'm going to keep these introductions a little shorter today, so because we do have a distinguished panel here. So I will start off by introducing John C. Cruden, who's a principal at Beveridge and Diamond. John was a career civil servant with the Department of Justice before becoming Assistant Attorney General of the Environmental and Natural Resources Division under President Obama. He also served as President of the Environmental Law Institute and Chief Legislative Counsel for the United States Army. John is a West Point graduate and a Vietnam veteran. He will be going first, but I want to introduce everybody so that way we don't interrupt the flow. Next will be speaking will be Horace Cooper, who's a senior fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research. He's chairman of the Project 21 National Advisory Board and a legal commentator. He is formerly a constitutional law professor at George Mason University and served as senior counsel to House Majority Leader Dick Armey. Going next, third will be Brian Israel, who's a partner at Arnold & Porter, where he chairs the firm's environmental practice group and co-leads the firm's ESG working group. Before joining Arnold & Palmer, Brian was an honors trial attorney in the environmental enforcement section of the Department of Justice. And then batting cleanup will be Susan Bodine, and she's a partner at Earth and Water Law. She formerly served as assistant administrator for the EPA's Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance. She was also chief counsel for the Senate Committee on Environmental and Public Works and the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. So we do have a very distinguished panel today, and the plan will be for each of the speakers to give about a 5 to 8 minute opening statement, and then we'll ask some questions, and then we'll open it up for the audience, and our plan is to end at noon, and then their lunch will be served right across the hall. So we know that this is a timely panel for a lot of reasons, and we did not have this planned, as much as folks think the Federalist Society is planning everything. Just last week, President Biden announced that he was going to create a new Office of Environmental Justice within the White House. We know that there have been a lot of recent initiatives, both on the policy front and the legislative front, dealing with the very topic we are here to discuss today. So without further ado, John, can you start us off?
Thank you, Mark. What a great conference. Good to see you all. Mayflower Hotel is kind of special to me. I'll try to tie this into a presentation there. And so, 2005, I got elected. It was an election to be DC Bar President, and they were announcing it at the dinner at the Mayflower. At that same day that that was happening, my youngest grandson was being birthed at Reston Hospital, which I would not want to miss. And so I am there with my daughter doing what every parent does. If you have two child, you take care of the first one while the second one was being born. There. It was successful. I then race from Reston to here. I park in the back. I'm changing into my tuxedo. You're in the car so I could rush in. As I walk in to the Mayflower, they're announcing me as being the next DC Bar President. Okay, now I'm going to tie it in try to make it relevant. The main speaker at that time, this DC Bar dinner, was Kurt Schmoke, who was then the mayor of Baltimore. By the way, he's now the president of University of Baltimore. And he spoke eloquently about civil rights in general, and then at the conclusion said, environmental justice is the new civil rights there. You know, I'm not exactly sure that all of that happened. It's probably the way that Kurt would have thought through, but it's certainly true that environmental justice has become a word that we're all familiar with. And it's now gone through numerous administrations there. It was born quite a long time ago, actually, born in largely out of the civil rights movement. And most of the people here know the history of that, where there were protests, there were studies out there. Church of Christ did a big one, reaching the conclusion, not surprisingly, that the pollution problems was disproportionately on minority and low-income communities, which I'm sure surprised absolutely no one. But out of that then became a series of administrative actions. Actually, President Clinton is given the credit for starting it with the executive order, but actually before him, President Bush, when I was still at the Department of Justice, had established what was the beginnings of environmental justice at the Department of Justice. So we have the executive order by President Clinton, and since that time, virtually every administration, just like a sine wave curve, have gone up or down of really pushing it strongly, making it, integrating it into enforcement and EPA decisions, or just watching it. But nobody has backed off. So it is a term now that has more strength to it than when Kurt spoke here at Mayflower and talked about it being the next a civil right issue. Certainly during my tenure during President Obama's administration. There was a White House task force on environmental justice led by, then by Gina McCarthy. Gina was the administrator of EPA. And there were, without question, largely emanating from EPA efforts to improve the minority poor community and with grants, I established with inside of Department of Justice an environmental justice coordinator looking at cases to see whether or not there were cases that should be brought or cases that we should handle somehow differently, largely trying to give a voice to the community, giving a voice to the people who otherwise would not have a voice in that process. Things improved, but clearly there was much more to be done. And there was really an absence of good data as well, trying to tie in where were the problems versus where were the communities that needed the most help. So all of that then comes ultimately to where we are right now. You'd have to be another planet not to realize that President Biden's environmental peaks of his tenure was climate issues and environmental justice. So from day one, President Biden emphasizing by executive order and by his own speeches what you already heard from Mark was this issue of the whole of government approach. So what does that mean? That means all the various components of the government have new responsibilities, and I'll come to that later when we talk about the new executive order in environmental justice. So they have responsibilities, it's part of their mission, they're talking about it, they're supposed to have plans that are there. And so it really took on new emphasis, I would say, during this administration. Parallel to that, we have states. Now, states that are taking actions, probably the most well-known right now is New Jersey, which has legislation. The California Attorney General's Office has established their own environmental justice task force, and so has a bunch of other states have done things in environmental justice. And even those that have not now look at that terminology and say some of the things that we've been doing already were really environmental justice, and so you see some of the labeling of their Environmental Protection Agency has come out with a screening tool so that it makes it easier to identify where there might be issues. And so again, without question, more emphasis during this administration. I am not part of the administration. Anything I say about the administration would be my own views, not their views for sure there. But again, just as a practitioner looking at what's happening, a lot of energy put into it. Some of the appointees are coming with that background in not just in EPA, but in other places as well. All right, so we have the sine wave curve starting out, with environmental issues, led then by President Clinton coming out with his own, Obama adds to it, and now Biden does it further. And what you were already told, kind of timely from Mark, is on Earth Day, then President Biden comes out with a new executive order, a long executive order. My law firm, Beveridge and Diamond, put out a summary, so you can go on a website and you can get that. You can also get the executive order itself. From there. What I'm going to do, which is completely unfair because it's a long executive order with a lot of parts, I just want to bring to your attention, largely because it might influence the discussion, which I look forward to, a half dozen things out of this executive order that I think are important. First of all, process is always important. Labeling is kind of important to everybody. And so now environmental justice gets a real home for the first time. During my tenure at Department of Justice, there was a White House task force on environmental justice, which I was a part of, and I told you Gina McCarthy led it, but there wasn't really a home there. So President Biden has created a home within the Council on Environmental Quality, so that's the White House office that does environmental things. Most well known because they do all the National Environmental Policy Act regulations, so that's how they're most well known. But they also do coordination of environmental issues inside of all administrations. That's now the home
So CEQ will establish the environmental justice group there, and that's going to be the new coordinating entity. I mean, I told you before that I thought early on one of the challenges in this area was good data. There was apocryphal sorts of things there, but I thought this was actually a plus. They're going to establish within their Office of Technology a new office that's doing data collection and doing good science. I thought that was important. This is all a government again. This is now an executive order that tells all the agencies, this is part of your mission, number one. Well, it was already kind of part of their mission. But now, more importantly, you're going to create a scorecard. So you're going to telling people how you're doing, and then you'll get evaluated, and that evaluation will be public. I've often said that one of the most effective of all environmental laws has almost no enforcement mechanism, the toxic release inventory, which only has publicizing what kind of emissions that you have come out of your factory, and without questions, it had a gigantic impact lowering emissions, because who wants to be at the bottom of the toxic release inventory? Well, you can see the same thing happening in federal agencies. If you're reporting how you're doing by whatever criteria is established, and I'll come back to that, you don't want to be at the bottom of that. So that's going to happen. How do you get the information? Well, the president also said within 6 months that this new group within the Council of Environmental Quality has to come out with their own guidance as to what these agencies will do. My guess is that's how they're going to have the scorecard for the other federal agencies. Shouldn't be lost on anybody looking at where they placed it. They place it inside the Council on Environmental Quality, which I already told you has the National Environmental Policy Act responsibilities, or NEPA. And so it would seem pretty clear that environmental justice, which is already included in a number of NEPA analysis, now will be way more routine for it to happen. There will be an annual report there. And now it was kind of true already, but the concept of environmental justice, which we sort of think of as pollution, disproportionate, on poor people, they very intentionally have included Native American issues, tribal issues in that as well. So the concept of environmental justice has been formalized a bit to include tribal issues. Within the Department of Justice, my old home, the person that I established to be the environmental justice coordinator inside of the Environment and Natural Resources Division, long-term career prosecutor, Cynthia Ferguson, terrific woman, is now responsible for environmental justice coordination writ large. Now way beyond the Environment Division, so picks up civil rights issues and other sorts of issues inside. Grant issues. Grant issues are important because money came out of IRA to environmental justice issues, so grant issues are important. So she now has that, and we've seen some investigations labeled as environmental justice investigations coming out of the Department of Justice. Okay, that's quick and short as a summary of kind of where we are, but this is kind of cutting-edged, because I'm sure everybody will talk about what we think the new executive order means there, but I would urge again, certainly those of you that are practicing, take a look at the executive order itself, because it's long, it's arduous, and it's going to affect every agency within the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I will note for the record, or for anyone scoring at home, or anyone paying attention at least, that John took about 10 minutes. So I know we said 5 to 8 minutes. So if everyone else wants to take 10 minutes for purposes of fairness, feel free to go over a little bit. And also I will say, and I'm sorry, that I just realized, because if I'd been good at math, I'd have gone to medical school, but I just realized that the speakers are actually in the order they're speaking. So Horace, you're next, and then of course we'll have... So anyway. Right, carry on.
Well, sorry. My grandmother told me fairness was overrated. So I will not take my entire 10 minutes that maybe justice would allow me to. What I would say is that, and this is likely part of the whole process, when I was a young man, my mother and father, when they married right out of high school, and they had two children, and then they decided, well, wait, we need some skills, we need some talents, we need some training. And my grandmother ended up being a backstop, and very often over about a 6-year period, we were just dropped off with my grandmother, and many of the skills, many of the success strategies that helped me become a mature, developing, and independent person came as a consequence of that. And so it is somewhat of an ode to my grandmother when I say that today what I'd like to talk about is when environmental justice isn't. Now, one of the observations is that there hasn't actually been federal authorization of this. Yes, there's been some funding, but Congress hasn't actually gathered, sent to the president legislation, making sure that this entire enterprise was formally adopted and mandated on the rest of America. Our founders intended, if you're going to have this kind of macro policy, of course it would come from Congress, go to the president, and then be imposed. Instead, some 28 years since that initial William Jefferson Clinton executive order, successive administrations have managed to fund these types of EJ programs, environmental justice programs. Now, I would argue that it is largely a consequence and a testimonial of the power of the administrative state that such a far-reaching and comprehensive effort has been able to be established all but unilaterally by political appointees and then allowed to flourish. It's billed environmental justice as the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income, with respect to the enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. But that is not what environmental justice is. It is premised on a phony notion, and that is that America's environmental remediation efforts have been primarily focused on aiding what it describes as the mainstream of America. That's progressive speak for whites. But what it is instead is a redistributionist belief system which masquerades as environmental policy. It is, environmental justice today is the latest iteration of environmental alarmism. And most importantly, it raises the specter that the odious policy where the government looks first at your race and ethnicity before offering or withholding services. My grandparents lived in a world where to be of a certain race or a certain ethnicity meant you either had a benefit, most often not, or you had a detriment. The people that they saw on the other side of the equation often had a benefit, whereas they had a detriment. When we as a nation came together with a welcoming policy of equality, we didn't premise it on, now we're going to go after a new group by their race and their ethnicity. We announced as a society we were ending this idea. There's no whites only. There's no blacks enter this way. And the evil of what happened to Rosa Parks wasn't evil because she was black. It was because she was an American. EJ says, let's return back to the days where the best way to assess whether a policy ought to be offered is first, let's make an inquiry about race. And it has to allow for a major and dramatic concentration of political power as a way of doing this. Just as when my grandmother and grandfather grew up, the world couldn't operate to stymie their aspirations without the overarching power of government. Today, that is still true. When the Depression occurred, my grandparents found that many of their neighbors, who happened not to be black, were just as much harmed and just as much willing to collaborate, just as much willing to share from the eggs that were grown on the farm, or just as much willing to share resources from the vegetables, or just as much willing to share what happened in the pond. Necessity caused them to be willing to break down that barrier. And it required a very, very extreme and coercive effort. Why I mention this is, Americans who lived under segregation suffered. Let me repeat that. Americans suffered. If you were white and you operated a dress shop, you couldn't sell to everybody, and you suffered. If you were black and you operated a dry cleaner, you couldn't sell to everyone, and you suffered. Today, the environmental justice system is going to bring us right back to that same phenomenon. The consequence is going to be that those who are at the least among us are going to be those that suffer the most. Environmentalists have captured, those activists have captured this policy arena, and they have wrested it away from America. Not racists have done so, but the consequences have been that many minorities often are harmed. Whether it's fuel economy standards, whether it's energy restrictions, the clean energy agenda has a huge and harmful consequence. Black Americans, minorities, working class Americans find there's four more months left over at the end of the paycheck precisely because the alarmists have put in place policies that price them out. It limits their schooling. It limits their wealth creation. It creates far more problems than it solves. In closing, I recommend that you look at our website, Project 21. We have a document. It's called Environmental Justice, What It Means for Black America. But you can replace that with any group. We at Project 21 don't believe that it will be possible until America recognizes that an out-of-touch elite operating more like a religious cult than a movement based on science gives back their undue influence and power. That will let America have environmental justice.
Thank you, Horace Bryan.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here, and I was asked to speak to defend the Biden administration after Horace Cooper, which I talked to my dad this morning. He's the last Democrat in Tennessee, or one of the few last, and he said, "Get off the stage. This is not a good setup." So I'm gonna do my best. I'm not actually. It's actually a strange choice for me to. Necessarily defend the Biden administration. I'm not part of the Biden administration. I'm at a law firm. I represent companies. Just last week, I filed a petition in the Third Circuit opposing this EPA for some chemical regulation as being out of touch with reliable science. So, but in any event, I'm gonna give a little bit of a perspective. I do have a background on environmental justice issues. I worked my first job while in law school at NYU was working for the West Harlem Environmental Action Committee, and my first summer job as a law student was working for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights on environmental justice issues. And my boss at the time, a woman named Dion Ferris, said, "Environmental justice is not about equal pollution; it's about equal protection." And in a sense, how Jeff would introduce this panel about. Really understanding environmental justice in the context of our shared commitment to justice is important. And I think environmental justice, my perspective is that it really shouldn't be controversial. a lot of the technical aspects of what environmental justice, the environmental justice agenda is trying to achieve, should not be that difficult for us to embrace. One example, a little bit technical, but as many of you know, environmental regulation, environmental policies, the cleanup of Superfund sites, the regulation of chemicals is based on risk assessment. Risk assessment is, while it is true, as Horace said, there's no congressional mandate that says thou shalt do risk assessments in a certain way. Risk assessments are part of our administrative regulatory process in really all aspects of environmental law. And it has been observed, and one of the features of risk assessment essentially is to find out how much of a chemical is dangerous. When you're exposed to a chemical, will it hurt you? At what levels? And one of the goals of a risk assessment, and has been for years, has been to understand that chemical, not just on the general population, which is great if you're protecting the average, but also what is the impact of that chemical at certain levels on susceptible populations, such as the elderly or children. That's been part of risk assessment for a long time. However, one thing that risk assessment, until recently, hasn't looked at very rigorously is what happens if you're exposed to more than one chemical. If you live in a neighborhood where you have multiple sites, or Superfund sites, or factories, or pollution sources, how do those chemicals interact? And are there cumulative impacts, synergistic impacts? What are your particular susceptibilities because you have access or don't have access to healthcare? There are a number of elements that people experience that risk assessment, which is the underpinning of all of our environmental regulation, doesn't look at. And so one environmental justice shouldn't be controversial. One environmental justice imperative is to expand how we think about risk assessment to consider those additional impacts on a particular site. So I'm just going to point to four. John, I think, gave a great introduction to the executive order. I'm going to point to four elements, concrete elements of this administration's in a descriptive, not an advocacy way. Four elements that I think are noteworthy from the Biden administration. Number one is, while it is true that environmental justice is not new, while it is true that President Clinton issued an executive order, we have not seen until the Biden administration the degree of comprehensiveness and systematic metrics and concrete objectives and goals, numerical goals. We've not seen anything like what we're seeing today in the environmental justice space. Putting aside whether that's good or bad, it's a very important thing to know. This EPA has a strategic environmental justice plan. I'll give you an example. They have stated a goal to have 55% of all inspections of plants, 55% of all inspections will be at quote-unquote environmental justice communities that have been identified as overburdened. So again, without advocacy, we have to know that. We have to recognize that this EPA is very serious and very quantitative about environmental justice. It's not it's not aspirational in a generic or qualitative sense. It's very quantitative. That's number one. Number two, it's very clear that to get a permit from this EPA or from a state that's being monitored or guided by this EPA, you have to consider cumulative impacts. We can give example after example after example already in this administration in Alabama, in Illinois, in Texas, in Houston, where permits have been denied because the applicant had failed to consider cumulative impacts. What is the impact of this proposed facility or expansion or highway in light of other stressors on the neighborhood or the community? Again, without advocating, without saying good or bad, we need to know that. If we're representing companies that are trying to do business in today's world, that cumulative impacts, sometimes under NEPA, sometimes under other statutes, cumulative impacts are critical to this government, to this administration. Number three is Justice 40. We're not talking so much about climate policy and climate justice, but it actually goes, I think, to the point that Horace was making. Justice 40 is the government's initiative to ensure that 40% of all benefits, all spending, all of the initiatives that this administration is pursuing, 40% of those benefits are being experienced by overburdened or disadvantaged communities. And then the fourth and last thing, which is huge, and it's been alluded to, but the Inflation Reduction Act, I think everyone knows, includes $3 billion of grants and technical assistance that is directed to go to disadvantaged communities for environmental justice projects. This includes hiring of scientists, it includes remediation, it includes creating green space, et cetera. And all of that money has to be allocated by 2026. So this is actually a congressional authorization related to environmental justice, and it's serious. And there's a lot of money that's going to be put into the system, and that's going to affect business. Which brings me to my last point. I represent companies that are trying to clean up Superfund sites, trying to get permits, trying to get grants from the Department of Energy for hydrogen projects, whatever it is. You cannot operate as a business today without having a serious environmental justice perspective, some cases a policy, a sophisticated approach to interacting with communities, to dealing with cumulative impacts, et cetera. So whether you like it or not, and whether you anticipate the Biden administration will be around for 2 years or 6 years, it's a phenomena that's at many states. So in order to operate as a business in today's world, you have to have an environmental justice, you have to have attention to environmental justice concerns, and that's one of the I think one of the most important takeaways and one of the aspects of my job, which is very interesting and what I find critically important as we try to help companies navigate today's reality. So those are my opening comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Susan will be the final speaker on this panel before we do open it up for questions.
So I get to pick cleanup, and I think I also bring to the discussion some of a practical kind of real world implementation examples from all the hats I used to wear, not only the head of enforcement, but in the Bush administration, the head of the office called OLM now, Land and Emergency Management, that does the Superfund cleanups, does the regulation of hazardous waste. So lots of different aspects there. I'm going to talk about the new executive order. I'm going to talk about injunctive relief. I'm going to talk about targeting, which I think Brian already mentioned. And then I'm going to talk about new enforcement priorities, just like that. So the new executive order. The Clinton executive order has been around since 1994. Agencies are very accustomed to applying that. And what it says is that federal agencies must identify and address the disproportionately high and adverse human health or environmental effects of their actions on minority and low-income populations to the greatest extent practicable and permitted by law. All right, you need adverse and you need disproportionate. I am concerned that the new executive order no longer actually requires an analysis of that, but might assume it. And I have to say, as an aside, that may or may not be intentional. Back in the Bush administration, I worked on a rulemaking, and some of the environmental advocates, including Dion Ferris, disagreed with the order and thought it had EJ impacts. The staff had written up the analysis that said, no, this protects everybody equally. When the Obama administration came in, they redid the rule, and they did a new EJ analysis that assumed noncompliance with the rule. And if you assume noncompliance, you are always going to have an adverse impact, and so depending on locations, you'll have an EJ problem. The new executive order defines communities with environmental justice concerns based on income, color, race. But the executive order also says, and this is not a question, this is not an analysis, it's a statement, that communities with environmental justice concerns, quote, experience disproportionate and adverse health or environmental burdens, close quote. So that isn't an analysis, that's an assumption. And so if you start with that assumption, you're always going to have an environmental justice problem that you need to solve. The executive order, of course, goes on and on and on, and I do encourage folks to read it. There's a lot embedded in there. It's important because executive orders are issued by the president. I personally think it's the president's prerogative to provide direction to his or her administration staff. It is not law. It is policy. It's direction. But again, within the authorities that are in law, it's totally a presidential prerogative to say, do things this way. No problem with that. That makes it very powerful. And so if you look at the section, one of the sections actually gets into a little bit on the enforcement issues. It talks about, a little bit about increasing knowledge, increasing things like fence line monitoring, increasing public information, increasing reporting. Now that can be done in two ways. That can be done through regulation, and I have absolutely no problem with imposing all that through regulation because that's notice and comment, APA, fine. The other way that can be done is through enforcement settlements. And that I do have somewhat of a problem with if it ends up becoming regulating through enforcement, because then, of course, you're creating an unlevel playing field. Let me go back. When I was the head of the enforcement office at EPA in the last administration, I remember being briefed by the Department of Justice on a settlement, and there was something in there, and I don't remember whether it was fence line monitoring or third-party audits or something. And I said, why is that there? And the DOJ line attorney looked at me and said, because the OECA AA requires that something like this be in every settlement agreement. And I'm like, what? I'm the OECA AA. And so I went back, talked to the staff, and ended up rescinding a 2015 memo that my predecessor had issued on next generation enforcement, which didn't say must be in every settlement, but definitely was being read by the staff that it was a must in every settlement. My memo said that injunctive relief has to be case by case. It didn't say no, it didn't say yes, it just said there's no presumption. One of the first things that after this Biden administration came into office, of course on day one, I think President Biden had an environmental justice executive order, agencies implemented, and my old office did rescind my 2018 memo, did not reinstate the prior one, and instead maybe took a middle ground. But there's a lot in there on what kind of injunctive relief there should be, including fence line monitoring, including things like increased reporting or putting up information for communities, et cetera. So my question there is, okay, are we gonna go back to regulating through enforcement, or is the thumb on the scale? Are the DOJ line attorneys gonna say, it has to be in every settlement? We'll have to see. I actually don't know. There are some legal constraints. I guess I'd have to say, mitigation of past environmental harms, that's pretty normal. Some statutes are more expressed than others, but nonetheless pretty normal. I personally have no problem with supplemental environmental projects. I know some have had problems with that. And I certainly don't mind injunctive relief that says come back into compliance. I get concerned when you start getting into things that are not mitigation, not a SEP, and beyond compliance. And frankly, an example of that was the VW settlement with the $2 billion investment for the EV electric vehicle charging stations. That was not labeled. If you look at that consent decree, it's not labeled, in any of those categories. It was kind of an add-on, and I won't go into the history of it. I wasn't there. I've only heard. But the troubling thing about that was that it was already a market decision that had been made by VW, and the stations that they were building across the country were the fast charging ones, which at the time only their vehicles could use. So it was a benefit, a marketing benefit to them that they're getting credit for in a settlement. Now, the other cars have all caught up, so it's no longer, you know, a marketing benefit, but it was at the time. So, you know, I had a concern about that. The other thing about the injunctive relief is that it may not always, the new kind of expanded injunctive relief may not always be possible, and I would point to an Eighth Circuit case in August of 2021, I think it was, yes. Ameren coal-fired power plant, the settlement which went through, you know, in the last administration, had mitigation by putting controls not only on the offending plant, but also on a plant owned by the same company, and it was about, you know, a couple billion dollars worth of emissions controls. The court said you can't do that. The court said Clean Air Act requires you to mitigate for a violation, or actually it requires injunctive relief to address the violations. And of course, the other plant had no violations. It was merely owned by the same company. So I think that's interesting. It may be interesting to see how that plays out and how, you know, if people want to challenge injunctive relief. Most of these are settled. And basically, a settlement's a contract, and somebody, you know, can agree to anything. You might argue it's coercive, but nonetheless, a settling party can agree to pretty much anything. And a court and a judge acting, you know, in his equitable role or her equitable role can approve anything. So that would only really be a constraint if somebody is not settling, but in fact taking it all the way through litigation. Targeting. I'm already going over my time. But,
it's okay. I'll ask the first question. Talk to us about targeting.
Thank you. I'm so glad you asked that. I think that Brian already mentioned it, but in the you know, in the president's budget, they have set budget metrics for targeting. The goal for 2022 was, or is, 45% of inspections and 50% in 2023 and 2024 in EJ communities. Philosophically, I don't think it's just me. I think the Office of WECA has had a problem with that because you go after environmental violations, you don't target based on, you know, the makeup of a community. EPA has always looked and done EJ screens on their enforcement actions, but it's not targeting. It's okay, we're taking actions, and then let's look at the environmental justice impacts, and of course in establishing injunctive relief, that could be relevant. Fine. But putting it up front, the question is, okay, are you going to misallocate resources? It may not matter as a practical matter, because when you do your retroactive review, huge number, yeah, a lot of the cases are already in EJ communities. I think that certainly in 2017 it was over 33%. 2018, I didn't see the stat, it was like 900 screenings though. That was 18-19, over 619 enforcement actions in EJ communities. 2020, you know, that was 531, that was the COVID year, and 778 EJ screenings. Okay. And that was the last year, actually, ironically, that EPA has reported on their EJ actions. I think maybe under the new executive order we'll see more reporting. But the question, the philosophical question is, do you target up front or do you look at it afterward? Finally, priorities. The question, so we set priorities that applied from 2020 to 2023. So actually the current administration is still operating under the previous administration's enforcement priorities. They have out for comment, or did, comment periods closed, proposing new priorities. EJ specifically isn't one of them because it's supposed to apply throughout, which is fine. But the question I had, and what I did when I changed the enforcement priorities was say, no, we should be aligned with the strategic plan. That's what they're proposing to do, which has a lot of climate and EJ in it, no problem with that. And that we shouldn't be going after specific industries, we should be going after environmental problems. They don't, on its face, they don't do that, but when you look at their Federal Register notice and their documents, it looks like the oil and gas sector in particular is gonna have a big X on its back for a variety of reasons. So remains to be seen, you know, how these are implemented, and is it gonna become targeting industries, not environmental problems, but again, remains to be seen. And if I may just talk like one sentence on Title VI.
Go.
Okay, sorry.
Sorry.
All right, Title VI.
Oh, that's one sentence. No, I'm just kidding.
I knew you were going to do that.
All right, 1 minute. And may not intentionally discriminate. There's no private right action, but people can petition EPA to act. Fine. EPA can withhold funding. Threat is usually enough, so it can be an enforcement tool, a powerful tool. Here's what people need to know. Compliance with environmental law is no defense. So somebody can say, ask the agency to withhold money under Title VI, even though, and ask a state to withhold your permit, even though you're completely in compliance with the law and the test is discriminatory effect, not intent, and a discriminatory effect could be based on any increase in your cumulative burden, one molecule is enough on paper. So that's, if that gets fully implemented, that too is an enormously powerful tool.
Thank you, Susan. We will open it up to questions if people want to step up. And before we do that, let me just kind of prime the pump by asking a question. As you know, Brian, as you were talking about the commitment to 40% of funds benefiting disadvantaged communities, and we've heard a lot in these conversations recently about environmental justice. And I think one of the fundamental questions I, like a lot of other people have, would like to hear all the panelists answer is environmental justice about the environment and preserving the environment, or is it really about justice for disadvantaged communities? Like, what is the focus of it, or is it just a way to blend a couple of things together to essentially redistribute wealth in some way? So I just don't know if anyone has any thoughts on, is it really, should the focus be on the environment, or should it be on disadvantaged communities? Anybody want to take a shot at that?
You said Brian, but...
But I mentioned, because you said the 40%, so... Okay.
It's interesting. I think Horace made the point that the clean economy, the clean agenda, I think you called it, the clean energy agenda will adversely impact Black communities, communities of color, and poor communities. I think Justice 40, while maybe a crude tool, is trying to address that concern by stating that, look, we're about to spend a lot of money transitioning to a low carbon economy. Organically, there'll be winners and losers. Let's try to direct that to communities that would otherwise not be participating in that transitioned economy. But.
So for a different take, one thing I think is important for us to understand, and that is that the so-called environmental remediation agenda is largely motivated by one of the most politically well-connected groups in America, and those individuals end up actually driving policy. If we were looking at them racially, they're almost monochromatic. Nearly 66% of your typical eco-warrior is white American. Now, the idea that that group, for the last 25 or 35 years, which owns, which dictates, which directs largely the environmental agenda, has purposefully singled out minorities on the basis of their race, beggars disbelief. What they have, however, done is just simply ignored the interests of the population so that we have energy poverty. Working class Americans, many minority communities find that the cost of keeping the home warm is a choice that must be made between that and getting grandma's medicines or foods. Certainly no tutor. What we end up with, and it was mentioned earlier, that there are states that are voluntarily opting in to regulate or enact statutes where the federal government hasn't. What we end up seeing is an exacerbation of differences in terms of wealth and income with regard to minorities. This so-called environmental justice agenda, which is supposed to address the lack of inequities, is going to exacerbate it. It is going to make it far worse. A lower cost access to energy, policies that say to distressed communities, we will make it easier for permitting, we will make it easier for construction, we will make it easier for infrastructure development, will bring income, resources, job opportunities to many of these communities. Policies that say we must protect you from that will only push those communities further to the back of the political bus.
Mark, I'd like to answer a question with an example. So I was Assistant Attorney General, but long before then I was Chief of Enforcement at Department of Justice for environmental issues. So here's my example. We saw it, Susan saw it. Wastewater treatment plants in the United States are extraordinarily important, right? We have one in District of Columbia, Blue Plains, that discharges into Potomac River. Very often, like Blue Plains, Potomac River is a drinking water source for all of us here, by the way. And so as we were doing cases, we found, not surprisingly, that the impact of discharging in a, over your permit, so that's an illegal discharge, that it had the impact was a downstream impact. Not surprising, right? Those tended to be disadvantaged communities. Those tended to be communities that simply didn't have the same voice as you and I did to object to all of that. We didn't call it environmental justice, but when I think about it now, I think it's that combination, Mark, is a combination of a disadvantaged community and an environmental issue, and very often, those were health issues.
Thank you very much. Okay, now we'll open it up to the audience questions, and if you can step up to the microphone, maybe say your name. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Devin Watkins from CEI. It appears to me that environmental justice really has a problem under the equal protection of the law, specifically as it applies to the way this administration seems to be implementing it. Not generally, and not all administrations, but the way that it uses disadvantaged communities, in my mind, seems to be very associated with certain racial groups that I know that the tool that they're using to identify what areas are disadvantaged does not include race explicitly as a part of it. But the way that it seemed to be created, at least from my perspective, was one that seemed to be trying to associate other factors that aren't race with certain racial groups to ensure that those racial groups were a part of the disadvantaged communities. And so while it is facially neutral and not racially discriminatory, it does seem, in my, to me at least, to be have the intent of racial discrimination, of targeting specific racial groups. And for if it is intentionally discriminatory in that way, it would seem to be a violation of the 14th Amendment. And I was wondering what the panel's thoughts were on that.
Anyone want to tackle that? Anyone want to?
Okay. It's interesting that you focused on the intent as opposed to the impact. What so much of the left has told us is that we need to measure it at the end, not the inputs at the beginning. I will just tell you that typically poorer communities have less likely the ability to update their households so that they are using much more efficient energy capabilities or capacities. When you talk about automobile purchases, in a community where the market environment is open, more minorities end up, as we saw during the 4 years of the Trump administration, buy some of the most safe, some of the most fuel efficient, and some of the most technologically advanced vehicles. What we've seen in the last 3 years has been a complete reversal of that. So if the test is impact, it's pretty clear that the policies that make it more difficult for people to have access to resources, to energy, to the ability to have a growing, vibrant, and expanding economy disproportionately hurts minority communities. Now, as I made in my opening statements, it is clear they haven't specifically said we have a trigger that it's going to be your race. But when my grandmother was growing up, They didn't have time, the community that she lived in, didn't have time to put up signs everywhere saying, no, you can't because of your race, or yes, you can because of your race. But pretty much people understood this. Now, the courts have in fact ruled, starting in the early 1920s and heading prior to the civil rights period, that the provisioning of government services may not be predicated on the basis of your race. The boast of environmental justice is that we're going to start provisioning a remediation on the basis of race, even if the specific trigger isn't one of an intentional discrimination. It feels like it, it looks like it, and it's all the more reason why Congress needed to act to authorize this instead of allowing it to go forward. Yes, ma'am.
Mark, yeah. Just some limitations on Justice 40. So it's, you know, it is an executive order, but it's a goal. And to your point and to Horace's point, there are constraints. There's constraints under Title VI as well as 14th Amendment. But in my view, the real constraints are the authorizing statutes that authorize the funding. The vast majority of funding is actually going out through formula programs because that's the easiest and fastest way. And my lens is EPA. So I'm not speaking for the rest of government. When I look at EPA's money, it's the fastest and easiest way for to get the money out the door. The states then have to allocate it. Congress set up the funding programs. Talk about disadvantaged communities in these programs and said very specifically, whether it's Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, it's particularly in the Drinking Water Act, that states decide. States have to decide what is a disadvantaged community. It's not race, it's disadvantage, and a state decides. And frankly, it's going to be different in various parts of the country, what is a disadvantaged community. So yes, there's a goal out there, but the ability to implement it actually is constrained by law.
Yeah, and we can move on to the next question. I would just add this. I think that I'm not a panelist, but if I understood the question, obviously there's constitutional challenges based on a statute being facially unconstitutional versus as it's applied. And so I think what we're talking about, what your question essentially says, is that, well, it looks like they're trying to craft policies that are essentially facially neutral but aren't. So I guess at some point someone's going to have to bring a challenge and say, well, as applied challenge versus a facial challenge. Okay, next question.
Hi, I'm Mike Penders, Environmental Security International. I remember being on the 10th floor of EPA in 1992, where it turned out to be the last year of the first Bush administration, when we were approached by environmental justice groups and civil rights groups to consider this concept of environmental justice in our target and other resource allocations by what became OECA eventually, some years later. And for the reasons, Mr. Cooper, you identified, as a former prosecutor myself, this was problematic to target enforcement, particularly criminal enforcement of laws, because firm believer, as our previous questioner, anytime you try for more than due process under law, someone gets less. And it seemed an inappropriate basis for targeting. With respect to targeting, the famous dissent by Justice Jackson when it comes to targeting individual or groups, how problematic that is and what issues that raises as an exercise of investigative or prosecutorial discretion. So we took that under advisement then, and then the Clinton administration came in.
Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Sorry.
The question
I was
compelled to give a little background. But we came up with a document to inform the exercise of investigative discretion based on harm and human health to the environment, and to be able to set that forth as an investigative discretion document. And if you target on that basis as an exercise of investigative discretion with limited resources, The question to Mr. Cooper, do your issues go away as long as you show the nexus between the exercise of enforcement discretion and environmental harm and human health based on risk assessment principles?
Well, I think the catechism of the radical progressive movement gets upset that they aren't able to pick and choose. Let me just explain. Here's what I want to see. I want to see analysis and data presented in a hearing that is part of the authorization process that shows that, in fact, there are roads that are racist. There are bridges that are racist. I want to actually understand, and I think America deserves to understand. It is a very, very convenient trope to simply say, we're taking hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, and placing it over here because there was once a problem. Now, in the EEO context, an employer is not allowed, because of an allegation of a prior mistreatment of some of his workforce, to systematically discriminate against a new workforce as a way to remediate that. They're required to go into court, they're required to have a finding made, and make sure that this is the least, most intrusive way to operate. What I'm watching is that we make these broad declarations by the very community that has yet to come forward and explain, mea culpa, we, the activists, we have systematically denied the Native American population. We have systematically denied indigent groups. There's been no such claim of that sort. And the idea that in the 1990s, the early 2000s, or even in the 1980s, that American environmental policy, without that kind of showing, has been systematically under-including protection for groups that need it today. Just the data does not appear to show that.
I think there could be a healthy debate on the data. There are definitely studies that I believe studies that show enforcement dollars are lower in certain communities, that remediations are slower in certain communities, there's certainly more pollution sources in certain communities, and you can go through the litany of environmental issues and show data. But independent of that, as a reality, this government and the state governments are within their enforcement discretion and their permitting discretion are going to be concerned, or are concerned, and have been for some time on environmental justice considerations. So if you're a company trying to get a permit or trying to get a grant or trying to get funding or trying to get a cleanup of a site, you need to be aware of that, and you need to address, you need to understand what are cumulative impacts at your site, for your program. You need to understand how you're going to engage with communities, because this is the reality. This is the reality that companies are living with.
Thank you. Okay, we've got time for about one more question, so step on up.
One more question, thank you. First, Mr. Cooper, delighted to make
Who are you?
My name is Bonnie Wachtel, and I'm in the investment business, which is the basis for this question. First, I just wanted to say, Mr. Cooper, I hadn't experienced you before. I'm definitely going to look up Project 21. So if one studies the automobile industry, recently the point that's most obvious is that interest in electric vehicles has come almost entirely from the generous tax subsidies that go to buying them, all of which go to wealthy Americans who are buying wealthy new cars with a generous tax subsidy. There's really no question about that. It's also known that we don't have enough battery technology and minerals to actually make a large-scale transition to electric vehicles for everyone. Pair that with CAFE standards in places like California, there's just no question that the government in its environmental efforts is making it much more difficult for people at the lower end of the spectrum or middle Americans to afford an automobile. So when I look at that general mosaic of what's happening, it's antithetical to what is supposedly the idea behind environmental justice. I mean, in a sense, it looks like misdirection. Don't look at where the money's really going, which is to wealthy Americans, because we'll have this big environmental justice program, largely going to Democratic donor groups. I mean, is there some way to bring an action under this statute on the basis of people who are being hurt along the lines that you're describing, Mr. Cooper? That's probably a rhetorical question. So the real question will go to Mr. Israel. Why on earth should this be non-controversial? I mean, it's basically changing the bedrock of what a lot of us think America's all about.
I think you identify some difficult problems. I think there are several of the subsidies. I'm not an expert on subsidies for electric vehicles, but I believe that many of those, the new iteration of those subsidies do have income limits, but others can speak to that. In any event, that's clearly one way of addressing your concern.
Susan, does anybody else have any comments? Anybody else?
So not an expert on subsidies, and this is outside of environmental law, but kind of going to, you know, maybe harkening back to this prior discussion about using economics to make policy decisions. And frankly, from my 14 years also working on Capitol Hill, when there's a lot of money out there, you have a lot of corporate interests going after the money, helping direct the policies, and then benefiting from it. So it's not about EJ, it's really not about the environment either, it's about the money. And that's how you see huge subsidies allocated, reality.
Of course.
I worked on Capitol Hill, and one of the things that I found fascinating, I guess it was 1997, we had the administrator, NHTSA administrator, come in and give us an update on some of their safety mandates. And they were forced to admit that the initial airbag safety mandates that now all of us take for granted, we really wouldn't want to go out to buy a car without one that contained airbags, was actually leading to the loss of life of more children under the age of 4 than it saved until they decided to modify what the airbag power or strength capability was. Automakers brought to their attention this problem, but because the agency could dictate, that was ignored until the number of deaths started to rack up. With environmental justice, what we are witnessing is a move that is going to ensure that more young inner city residents do not complete graduation. They are not going to be equipped as marrying capable because they don't have the skills to be attractive in the marketplace. Their children are not going to create wealth. And the reason for this is these policies divest. They are too expensive for communities to bear. And now, even under the most benign view, where we're just now giving more focus, that more focus is going to concentrate more enforcement in the very communities that really need the space to have a chance to prosper, create wealth, develop, and mature. Environmental justice, as I said when I stood up, isn't.
Well, I want to thank all the panelists today, and just one postscript to your question. I guess I was just doing a really quick postscript. I think that really goes to the issue of crony capitalism, which really cuts across all ideological lines. Because what happens is when the federal government gets bigger and bigger and bloated, it becomes unresponsive. And then you end up with these K Street lobbyists, you know, that essentially start picking winners and losers in the marketplace, and the government starts allocating resources to the their favorite industries. But I am not here as a panelist, so I'm sorry for that comment. Different topic, different subject. Anyway, I just want to thank all the panelists for being here today. Let's give a round of applause. Thank you.